The Democratic and Republican candidates, Hubert H. Humphrey and Richard M. Nixon, were willing to appease the communists, persuaded him to run. It was perhaps the worst decision of his life. Tough and disciplined as a commander, LeMay was a supremely incompetent politician. At the press conference announcing his candidacy, he refused to rule out the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam, the same implied threat that Eisenhower had made to end the Korean War sounded heartless and barbaric 16 years later, as images of Vietnamese women and children burned by napalm appeared on the nightly news. LeMay had strongly opposed sending ground troops to Vietnam and disagreed with McNamara's strategy for fighting a limited war there. "War is never cost-effective," LeMay argued. "People are killed. To them, the war is total." At the press conference, he stressed that the United States should always try to avoid armed conflict. "But when you get in it with both feet and get it over with as soon as you can." The logic of his argument received less attention than the tone-deaf remark that preceded it. "We seem to have a phobia about nuclear weapons." On the campaign trail, the general who'd risked his life countless times fighting the Nazis was jeered by protesters yelling Sieg Heil. He told reporters that the anti-war movement was communist-inspired, lost his job as an aerospace executive for running with Wallace, and largely faded into obscurity after their defeat. LeMay and McNamara, polar opposites who'd battled over a wide range of national security issues, each convinced that the other was dangerously wrong, now found themselves in much the same place. They ended 1968 in humiliation and disgrace, their views repudiated by the American people. An abnormal environment. On March 13, 1961, at about 11:30 in the morning, a B-52 took off from Mather Air Force Base in California, not far from Sacramento. The plane was on a chrome dome mission, carrying 2 Mark 39 hydrogen bombs. 20 minutes after takeoff, the pilot, Major Raymond Clay, felt too much hot air coming from the vents in the cockpit. He and one of the co-pilots, First Lieutenant Robert Bigham, tried to turn off the heat. The vents wouldn't close, and it became uncomfortably warm in the cockpit. Almost 7 hours into the flight, the control tower at Mather instructed Clay to continue mission as long as you can. If it gets intolerable, of course, bring it home. Before the second refueling, Clay guided the plane to a low altitude and depressurized the cabin to cool it. But it heated up again as the bomber climbed to 30,000 feet. 14 hours into the flight, the temperature in the cockpit had reached 160 degrees Fahrenheit, so hot that one of the pilot's windows shattered. Clay descended to 12,000 feet again and requested permission to end the mission. In addition to the broken window, a couple of the crew members were feeling sick. The cockpit had become so hot that Clay and his two co-pilots took turns flying the plane, going back and forth to the cabin below, where the temperature was a little cooler. Passing through overcast skies, the bomber flew off course, fell behind schedule by about 30 minutes, and lost another 7 or 8 minutes avoiding bad weather. 22 hours into the flight, First Lieutenant Bigham realized that a gauge for one of the main fuel tanks was broken. The reading hadn't changed for at least 90 minutes, but nobody had noticed amid the heat and the hassle of coming and going from the cockpit. Bigham asked the control tower to send a tanker. They were running low on fuel. 40 minutes later, while approaching the tanker, the B-52 ran out of gas. All 8 engines flamed out at once. At an altitude of 7,000 feet, the crew started to bail out. Major Clay stayed in the cockpit and banked the plane away from Yuba City, California, just 40 miles short of their base. Confident that the bomber wouldn't hit the town, Clay ejected at an altitude of 4,000 feet. The B-52 made a full 360-degree turn and then crashed nose-first into a barley field. The high explosives of both hydrogen bombs shattered on impact and didn't burn or detonate. The weapons harmlessly broke into pieces. All 8 members of the crew survived the crash, but an Air Force fireman rushing to the scene was killed when his truck overturned. Fred Eakley had predicted that as the number of nuclear weapons and airborne alerts increased, so would the number of accidents. He was correct, and the aircraft involved in those accidents had few safeguards to protect weapons during a crash. The Air Force considered the performance of a bomber or a fighter, its speed, maneuverability, capacity, and range, more important than its structural integrity. The B-52 had been designed in the late 1940s, and its designers never anticipated that the bomber would be used for airborne or ground alerts. It wasn't built to carry fully assembled nuclear weapons during peacetime. When the weapons were attached to the underside of a plane, they were fully exposed to the effects of a crash. And when they were carried in the bomb bay of a B-52, a Sandia report noted, they were located in a weak point in the aircraft's structure, a point at which the aircraft is apt to break open, spewing weapons beyond the protection afforded by the fuselage. On Johnston Island in the Central Pacific, tests designed to measure the effects of high-altitude nuclear explosions served as a reminder that missiles and warheads didn't always behave in predictable ways. On June 3, 1962, a Thor intermediate-range missile with a 400-kiloton warhead lifted off smoothly. But a radar tracking station failed, endangering ships in the area if the missile flew off course. The range safety officer decided to abort the flight. The command destruct mechanism blew up the missile, destroying its warhead. 2.5 weeks later, another Thor was launched, this time with a 1.4-megaton warhead. The missile's engine shut down after 59 seconds, and the range safety officer decided once again to use the command destruct mechanism. The Thor exploded at an altitude of about 30,000 feet. Pieces of the missile and the warhead, including plutonium from its core, fell on Johnston Island and the surrounding lagoon. About a month later, another Thor missile with a 1.4-megaton warhead misfired on the launch pad. It never got off the ground. The range safety officer gave the command destruct order, and a massive explosion destroyed much of the launch complex, showering it with debris, burning fuel, and plutonium. The next 2 months were spent rebuilding the complex and decontaminating the island. On October 15th, during the first use of the new launch pad, a Thor missile went off